Cheating the fifth, I am. Cheating the fifth, I am, I am. I'm a believer who will confess unless I work for the IRS. And everyone wants some honesty.
Honesty.
And hope he really follows this plan.
This plan.
But the way that things are going, we're gonna have a lot more scams.
Second term, watching them squirm.
I'm pleading the fifth, I am. Pleading the fifth, I am, I am. Don't ask questions or further explore, or I'll have auditors at your door. And everyone wants some honesty.
Honesty.
And hope he really follows this plan.
This plan.
But the way that things are going, we're gonna have a lot more scams.
I can assure you that I certainly did not know anything.
I've been advised by my counsel to assert my constitutional right, Fifth Amendment.
It's not my area. I don't know, but it certainly was inappropriate. No question about that.
What would be some of the reasons you might be at the White House?
The Easter egg roll.
I have no information or awareness of
there was no knowledge here at the White House.
I don't know.
What difference at this point does it make?
I'm pleading the fifth, I am. Pleading the fifth, I am, I am. He don't know and he can't recall, yet he was elected to lead us all. And everyone wants some honesty.
Honesty.
And hope he really follows this plan.
This plan.
But the way that things are going, there's gonna be a lot more scams. Oh yeah, there's gonna be a lot more scams.
Honesty is what we need.
Honesty, honesty. There's gonna be a lot more scams. Oh yeah, there's gonna be a lot more scams.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Big Brother is Watching. Heidi Bogosian talks about government surveillance, corporate power, and public resistance with Robert Scheer.
So let me ask you about the legal community that you have a lot of contact with as the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and so forth. Why are these people so out to lunch? Why is there not more outrage in this community?
In the community of progressive lawyers?
No, not progressive. Lawyers. They're supposed to believe in the rule of law. They're supposed to believe in living in government, the rights of the individual. Why are people asleep at the switch? Why do we have to lecture them about the evils of totalitarianism?
I think many lawyers and others are concerned. The government, the so-called unitary executive, has become so powerful that the George W. Bush administration's legal counsel wrote memos justifying torture. It was then immediately sort of played out on TV programs like 24. Torture's become normalized, and I blame the corporate media for being a part of that, because they dictate the realities, what we see. It's really all about control of information. It's about secrecy by government, and that includes not letting us see dead bodies coming back from Iraq, not seeing the damage and trauma that young American men who come back and women from the battlefields. It's about covering that up, and again, with corporations giving us a kind of propaganda, a message to make us more perfect consumers, but to also vilify the act of speaking out against such things, so that there may be angry voices saying that these things are wrong, but they don't get reported on in the media. When you see police with less lethal weapons attacking passive protesters at a crowd, all you see are images of police in riot gear with kind of scruffy protesters. You'll hear about mass arrests, but it will be months or years before you hear that those arrests were unconstitutional, that surrounding people with netting and for doing nothing wrong, then arresting them as they did with 700 occupiers on the Brooklyn Bridge who the police led onto the roadway, took them through stoplights, letting the protesters feel they were allowed to go there, but then they arrested them all. I think that we have such a sort of singular one-way message from government and corporate played through the media that, and I tried to include some stories of little resistors, be it school children who refuse to give a palm scan to get into their high school cafeteria for lunch. We don't hear about those stories. We're faced with an overwhelming amount of propaganda guised in the form of marketing and, as I mentioned earlier, brand loyalty to big business.
So, as they say on TV, the book is Spying on Democracy. And I let me ask you about the takeaway from this, because generally people say, okay, privacy, so what? My ex-wife or my ex-husband will know this. I can live with it. I like the convenience of shopping and not using a credit card and using my fingerprint, blah, 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 or scanning this, and so forth. What really you're talking about is the end of the democratic experiment. I mean, we're playing it down now. I don't know why for this discussion, but this is a very depressing book. I hate to say it, it's an informative book, but you're really talking about not, you know, giving up some of, you know, personal taste freedom and somebody will know this about me. We're talking about the totalitarian state, right?
Right.
Or am I putting words
in? No, we're talking about the totalitarian state.
I mean, basically the assumption of this book is that this thing protected in the Fourth Amendment of a space that's your own, where you can regroup, where you can meet with others, where you can exchange letters. Because, as Brandeis pointed out and others, it wasn't just in the home.
Right.
It was in your communication. It was wild thoughts while walking. It's personal space. And without that personal space for the individual, this whole idea of democracy, whether it's the Greek notion or whatever, it doesn't mean anything. Mm. You're in the crowd. You're observed at every moment. You have no time to think. You have no freedom to think, and so forth. And so the real message of your book is that this is a war on democracy. And,
yes.
And yet it's done in the name of protecting democracy. Well, that's always been the case. This was the rise of Nazism in Germany, Stalinism, what have you. It was always to protect some basic values and the right of the people. So again, I get back to the question, why is this not more alarming? Why do we sound like some oddball characters worried about this thing, knowing probably full well that when we get out of this meeting, we'll probably give away even more of our privacy, right? I mean, I'll probably look for some restaurant and give the information. I'll send an email that anyone can see, right? I'll make this phone call that can be tracked. Google can take a picture of my house, right? And everything about it. I mean, come on. Why is this more alarming? And you suggest what I think is, I can't believe it's true, but maybe it's true, that we trust the state? No, I mean, because that is sort of the assumption. It'll only be done to the other. Now, this is a denial, as I said at the very beginning, of the whole assumption of our society, which is a constitutional society of restraint on the state. You know, a restraint on power, built on suspicion of power, built on the need to protect individual right. And yet, as a culture, and maybe it's because of the dominance of, you know, the only way we think about freedom is consumer sovereignty, consumer freedom, and being free to be, you know, consumers, that we've lost that notion? Or what do we think it's only going to be, Muslims of a certain kind that are going to be persecuted and we don't have to worry about it? What? Because you deal with, right, you're out there, you're handling cases, you're dealing with people. What is the resistance?
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now, back to Big Brothers Watching with Heidi Bogosian and Robert Scheer.
I do think that children raised on the kind of technology that we have, and I mentioned in the book At Disney World, they have magic bands that you can wear on your hand to get through those long waiting lines if you give your personal identifying information. Cinderella will greet your child on his or her birthday, because after they go over the magic reader, it has a different name, but it's all made to be fun and friendly. I think with the government not, as I said, doing its job in protecting the most vulnerable people in our society, children who are raised now with advertisements, as I understand it, in some classrooms, and Coca-Cola sponsorships in the cafeteria. One of the issues I was always interested in when I was in graduate school was advertising to children during Saturday mornings, because they would have a cartoon and then a television ad that was animated so the kids couldn't tell the difference. And children develop manual dexterity and the ability to use computers far earlier than they develop the ability to discern between reality and fantasy. And I think that although computers and technology have opened up our lives, I like to liken it to the internet, the creators of which wanted this to be to foster more democratic communications, but in many ways we're seeing how it's being turned again to gather our personal data, to watch us, to control us. So I think that we're in a difficult period because so many people have been born along with the rise of technology taking this enormous burst, and the internet obviously has changed the world in ways that we couldn't have foreseen. So I do think consumerism and corporate control has made this more difficult. I do think it is a depressing scenario, but I don't think it's beyond hope. With awareness comes the possibility of change. I think the Snowden disclosures were the most important revelation that we've had in decades. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg from the Pentagon Papers has said that. I think that we have a window of opportunity to recognize where we are, that we have choices. It's not going to be easy, but it's our job to teach everyone else that, you know, I mean, I came to Berkeley, I've only been here a few times, but I see people, you know, wearing jewelry and sort of feel like I'm back in the 60s a little bit. And that was a period when it was, you know, great to protest or to be individual. And now we've been taught to sort of don't shake the boat, don't be a creative, free-thinking person. We have to reclaim our autonomy and our sense of personal creativity. One very frightening development in the Obama administration is a program he has, I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically if you think a fellow government employee might be a whistleblower, you have a duty to turn that person in. What does that do? It stifles creative thought and people thinking outside the box, which is just what we need, especially to come up with ways to protect the country or, you know, fight against this amorphous enemy that we've created. And again, being in a state of perpetual war is something corporations love. And when you have an amorphous enemy, that enables that. So I do think there's been a sea change with the Snowden revelations, and I hope it's just the beginning as more things come out.
Okay, let me, because we'll open up for questions soon, I think. You're in charge. Okay, but before we do, let me really push this in a positive direction. I think if we were just left to our non-military, non-imperial lives, we would straighten this out, because people don't like being intruded upon, and they would want to preserve their privacy, and they would pick those products and those cell phones and those carriers that gave them a measure of protection. And I think there would be a number of companies that would recognize that this is in their interest, rather than turning it over. I think what, and I'm, by the way, a big defender of the internet. I edit Truthdig, which I tell people is like I used to edit Ramparts in the old days, and Truthdig is Ramparts on speed. And, you know, our Chris Hedges article today may be read by millions of people around the world without cutting down another tree. And people on the internet can find all sorts of wonderful things, including Tom Paine or Ben Franklin or, you know, people like that. And they can counter lies, and they can find out what Snowden, I mean, whoever even heard of The Guardian, the English paper, and now lots of people know The Guardian. They can read The Guardian, and they can read the interview with Snowden, and the, you know, and so forth. So I think there are a lot of realists. What scares me is what really Washington, again, I've become a big Washington person, despite his contradictions, I'm very well aware of. There's this whole notion that you can't be both a republic and an empire in the same moment. Which is, I think, what drove the founders, that they saw the example not only of Rome, but obviously of France, of England, of Spain, that if you're going to be an empire, you're not going to have a government by the people, for the people. You're not going to have accountability. And the main push of our Constitution was an anti-imperial push. Keep things local, local level, keep them manageable. And so I see that as the main tension. Now, to be optimistic, even the same Obama who was playing the hawk and doing some of these things, and now we see a reversal. And maybe this won't last that long, but we saw an incredible coalition in Congress of Republicans and Democrats voting against getting into another war in the Middle East and Syria. We see opening to Iran, for example, and a willingness to try diplomacy over war. And I wonder whether the big issue over privacy isn't a fight over empire. That if you want to have an empire, you have to have secrecy. You have to have militarism. You have to have lying. And that the only way you can preserve democracy is by abandoning that and being a normal country. And what the war on terrorism is all about, really, is an effort to assert the imperatives of empire at a time when they really don't make much sense, when it's not economically, it is for some corporations, but it's not basically economically viable, and it costs a lot in human lives and resource. Do you see this as a source of optimism? Did I overstate it?
Well,
I did. Okay, I'm sorry.
I think the empire issue is accurate. I do agree that in the last even few weeks, we've seen enormously hopeful.
I should have thrown the Pope in, too.
And the Pope, yeah.
Because Ramparts, that I did once edit, we started as a Roman Catholic publication with Pope John the 23rd, I think, and now we have a 23rd? Yeah, I got it right. And now we have a Pope that at least seems to be similar in some ways. No?
I think that...
I know. Right. I'm afraid I'm going to be attacked on Washington also. But I mean, I'm looking for some marginal signs of improvement. Yeah.
I think, again, we have a window of opportunity. I think one of the tasks before us is the sharing of more personal narratives and communicating in communities that we've gotten away from. Let's replace the propaganda of a country that's been so focused on empire. All the mom-and-pop shops that are gone because of Starbucks and other very sterile businesses that want to dictate what kind of coffee we have and what choices we have. The most powerful power that exists is the power of the people. And that's why I'm so proud to work for the National Lawyers Guild, because we've defended protesters and individuals targeted by the government for over 76 years. We ourselves were spied on and infiltrated for four decades by the FBI. We sued them. We got them to admit it. Individual stories are really important to share, and once we lose that, we lose community, which I really think is what empire is fighting against. So I would just encourage people to try to be yourselves, speak out when you get angry, like the fellow in Network did, open your window and shout out, I'm not going to take it anymore. And don't lose sense of who you are and yourself, your creative being.
Has everybody heard of Woodstock 99? There were 400,000 people and 200 weirdos. That's 0.006%. And everybody who's heard about Woodstock 99 heard a fabricated fantasy. It wasn't that at all. I mean, I could go on, but... And then the other thing, which is really key, is how many people know about the RDF thing that you were talking about? It's in every article that you buy from Macy's. And when I wrote to the president of Macy's, he said, just cut them out, throw them in the trash. I mean, really? How many people know what you're even talking about? So, you know, you have no way for people to know this.
Well, I think people learn pretty quickly when their phone is stolen, when they get all these robocalls, when their privacy is, when they, you know, their identity is stolen. There are a lot of...
I was actually saying something different. I was saying that journalism no longer exists the way it did in 1999, which contributes to the fact that people can't get information.
Oh, I don't believe that for a minute. Let me defend journalism. First of all, I think we let me try. The reason, I'll do it. I don't think the good old days were so good. The bill that I talked about, the reversal of Glass-Steagall, as well as the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, was also signed by Clinton, which totally deregulated the derivatives market. All these things happened in the 90s, and the media didn't cover it in any kind of effective way. The New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post were cheerleaders for wild deregulation. We've had one lousy war after another that the media basically collapsed on. I don't think the New York Times and the LA Times, the Washington Post were pretty good on weapons of mass destruction or anything. So, we can glorify the old days of journalism. We had McCarthyism, we had attacks on civil liberties, we had segregation, we had lots of problems. It is true, the old model of journalism, which had some valuable things in it, sending reporters around the world to cover news and paying journalists, something I appreciate, being paid. We've lost that model, but we do have some positive things in their place. And as long as the internet is not shut down, and is not, one reason I'm very concerned about privacy is I want people to trust online communication. I want people to be able to investigate and do searches and find things out without thinking they're being watched all the time. I think people can now be their own journalists in many ways. People can enter. For instance, let's take somebody like Juan Cole, who is a professor, okay? And Juan Cole has probably been one of the most interesting writers about politics in the Mideast. And why? Because he can have a blog. He can get an audience. I don't know if he's familiar to you, but, there are plenty of people who were formerly stuck in the scholarly mode, and they would write little tracts that no one would read, and now they can find a mass audience. There's a lot of debate on the internet. The things you were talking about, for instance, Chelsea Manning, even Ellsberg is a big figure now. People quote him all the time, he lives about, I don't know, 8 blocks from here or something. I love the man, but he was a bit forgotten. And now he's seen as a hero, having stood up. He's a role model. And people want to know, what did Ellsberg do? I can tell you, I teach in a university, and I have 500 students that probably hadn't heard of Ellsberg. But I can tell you, in 2-3 hours, they can learn a great deal about him. And they can know more about the break-in of his psychiatrist's office and everything else, and what the government did. And so I think, I don't like to get bummed out by we lost our old mechanisms. I think... What is? No, I know. I understand. Tell me why it's troubling. Go back to the mic and tell me why it's troubling. I don't want to dismiss your question.
I'm not argumentative, but I did not put down current journalism. I did not say the good old days at all. I didn't refer in any way to that. I said that there's something broken about journalism. I gave a small reference that I was actually in the trenches, and I said that a simple thing that was mentioned here in the talk, like the little RDFs, how many people even know what they are or that they come from the Russian government? I mean, you know, I might know about it, but there's something in the dissemination of information that is a breakdown. It wasn't the good old days at all. And so, I mean, oh my God, is okay. It because I'm a redhead?
Oh, I'd like to answer. I think it's true. In the mainstream media, we don't read that kind of story. We don't, for example, at protests where we know there were 3,000 people, well, the police figures are, you know, far less. And you don't get, in many cases, the kind of reporting that some of us remember and maybe had heroes in Woodward and Bernstein. Investigative reporting on one level in the corporate media has lost its funding, and it's rare. But I do think we have a wonderful new medium in the internet where, and even with the evil cell phones that can take pictures, we have, you know, Rodney King, whatever instances of daily injustices that the mainstream media just doesn't cover and doesn't have the capacity to cover. So I agree with you, and I think we're not going to read about RFID chips a lot because it would horrify people. There's a wonderful book called Spy Chips by Catherine Albrecht and a co-author, and they do blog a lot about how Macy's shoe departments now has chips in every pair of shoes. And it's true, most of your clothes probably have an RFID tag. And there are ways to take it out, but we don't hear about that as much as some of us would like.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.